And welcome back, everyone. I am Lizzie, your Millennial Movie Matchmaker. Now, today I'm going to be doing a solo episode, much like my standard episodes. The past two have starred some really fun guests. I first had Chris from At Movies on the Regular, and we talked all things Golden Globes. And then this most recent episode, I had my husband on, and I have gotten a lot of really awesome feedback about that. I personally had so much fun with him, and I'm glad that you all did too. But today we are getting back to basics. Now, before I review what we're going to talk about today, I first want to give a shout out to the Retro Movie Roundtable podcast. You can find them on Apple, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher Premium, Google Play, anywhere where you can find podcasts. And they recently had yours truly on as a special guest to talk all things Titanic. So the Retro Movie Roundtable podcast actually picks one movie. They have one guest on and they dissect it to see if that particular oldie is an oldie but a goodie. So go ahead and check that out if you want to hear something a little different and overall, you know, my opinion on Titanic. So, okay, let's get in. So quick recap on how we do things here on the Millennial Movie Matchmaker podcast. I am going to pick a current up-to-date movie to review and then pick my top five within that same genre. Review my top five. And of course, in there, we got to have an honorable mention. I got to talk about the bad stuff too, even if it's so bad that it's oh so good or it's just flat out terrible. I want to talk about it with you guys. So, what are we going to talk about this week? This week, we are going to talk about the newest movie out on Netflix, Deadly Illusions. Now, this movie is starring Kristen Davis. She is most notorious for her role as Charlotte on the HBO series Sex and the City. You also got Dermot Mulroney and Greer Grammer. And it is all about a juicy situation in where a seemingly happy married couple hire on a hot nanny. And you know, you think from the outside looking in, okay, like I can tell you exactly what's going to happen here, right? You know, I've read the headlines. I know what Jude Law did. I've seen all the movies. I know how this story goes, right? Well, you know, this movie actually takes a bunch of twists and turns. And that's what I want to talk about today with you guys. I want to talk about movies that have my favorite plot twists. That is right. I want to talk about plot twists because that is one of my favorite things and favorite aspects about quality writing within a movie. You know, you think you know what's happening, you're comfortable, and then all of a sudden, bam, like right in the middle, Bruce Willis has been dead the entire time. I mean, holy shit. Can anybody, like, can you honestly? It's like that is one of those movies where I can honestly tell you like how old I was, where I was. Like there is just something about those movies that just jar you and they stay with you forever. And honestly, it is what makes movies so much fun. Now, I have to have a little disclaimer before we officially get started. I can't really talk about my favorite plot twists without actually discussing the twist itself. So I try my hardest not to spoil the movie for you, but I think that you can agree with me that this podcast is not going to be worth anything, this particular episode, if I don't actually discuss the subject at hand. Now, I'm not going to give away the plot twist in Deadly Illusions because I want you all to check it out. But going through my top five, y'all got to. And to be fair, most of these movies are at least, you know, 5+ years old. So, you know, honestly, like, what are you doing if you haven't checked these out? So little warning, little disclaimer, you have been warned. There will be spoiler alerts. All right, so let's go ahead and dive in, shall we? Let's do the honorable mention first. We are going to go with Last Christmas. Now, this is my honorable mention because this is first and foremost a Christmas movie. You know, I don't really associate plot twists with anything other than a thriller, but this had a pretty good one, and I want to talk about it. So we're gonna go for it. So this is starring Emilia Clarke. She plays Kate, and she is a wannabe singer. She's obsessed with George Michael, hence the name of the song. So everywhere she goes, it's like literally that last Christmas I gave you my heart. That's the only song she seems to know. So she's obsessed with Last Christmas and obsessed with George Michael. And she seemed to have it all until she had a very, very serious health scare, which required her to have a heart transplant. So she was able to have a successful one. And the movie actually starts post all of this, right? So it's taking place, showing you the aftermath of how the trauma of this health scare has really impacted Kate's life. Kate has kind of gone off the rails. She doesn't live in an apartment anymore. She's living with her parents. She's working as an elf in a Christmas shop in downtown London. And, she's kind of like a really awful person. She's not, she's just like miserable to be around. She just drinks herself silly. She's depressed. She's frumpy. I mean, this is quite the departure from Daenerys, Mother of Dragons. And I mean, I'm sure that's obviously probably why she took this role, but she's just like so crabby and cranky throughout this whole movie. And then all of a sudden she meets Tom. Now, Tom is played by Henry Golding. He, I feel like, really came on the scene with the movie Crazy Rich Asians. He was also opposite Blake Lively and Anna Kendrick in A Simple Favor. He has one of those really buttery voices. I always, like, my husband will tell you this. Anybody that I think could read me a lullaby or I'll read me a bedtime story that I could fall asleep to, like, those are the voices that I really, really gravitate towards. Just like somebody has like a buttery quality in their voice. And I would definitely say that Tom qualifies for this. So I, right off the bat, am a fan. So the two of them together clash at first, because Tom is like super happy. He's very happy-go-lucky. He's fun. He's a good time guy. And of course, for some reason, he's attracted to Kate. I personally can't tell you why, because she's grumpy and she doesn't wash her hair. So I am not really sure what he sees in her. But alas, the two of them start to bond, and he really does start to bring out this great side of Kate. So this is all obviously also taking place around Christmas time. It's primarily a Christmas movie. So where's the plot twist, you ask? Well, it turns out that once Kate and Tom take things to the next level, right? They have officially taken things to the bedroom and it's gotten physical. And now Kate is so excited that she has a real life boyfriend. It turns out that this was all a manifestation in her mind, and that Tom is actually the spirit manifestation, the illusion of the gentleman who gave his heart to Kate. He had died in a tragic accident very shortly before Kate went into surgery, and they harvested his organs, and his heart went to Kate. So this is so sweet because obviously it's symbolic, that he's giving his heart to her. But I have to say, the reason why this is my honorable mention as well is because, like, I was a little disappointed. I mean, it was super cute, but what now for her? Kate's been through enough. She's had to have a heart transplant, and now she's fallen in love. She has spread her legs for this ghost. She is really excited about having a boyfriend and having somebody to sit on the park benches with and people watch. And now that's like that just all goes away. And like, what's left for her now? Somebody that is in that fragile of a state of mind isn't just going to pick up her the pieces and just stay on this straight and narrow path. She's going to go back to the bottle and back to being a shitty, angry elf. I guarantee you, that's why they probably won't make a Last Christmas too. So, all in all, Go see this movie, or don't go see it. It's old. You can currently it's available on HBO Max for streaming. So you can absolutely stream it. It is worth it. On the off chance that you don't have HBO Max, I would not pay to see this movie. That is my recommendation. See it if it's free, don't if it's not. But if you are a massive, massive Daenerys fan, like yours truly, then, maybe give it a try. All right, moving on to my number five pick. And we are going to go with The Others. Now, this movie is starring Nicole Kidman. She plays the main character, Grace, and she has two children, Anne and Nicholas. And this is taking place in what I have to imagine is Ireland, just based on Nicole Kidman's voice. Gerard Butler, I saw him once on some talk show, and in which he is describing the main difference between Irish and Scottish, and I'll never forget it because now I can always distinguish an Irishman from a Scotsman. And that is the fact that an Irish accent is a lot softer, whereas Scottish tends to be a little bit more aggressive. And the word that he used, or excuse me, the phrase, I should say, or name that he chose to use this and describe the main differences between the two, to distinguish the two, was to use the name Britney Spears. And he said, when you're saying Britney Spears as an Irishman, it's gentle. Britney Spears, Britney Spears. But then when you're Scottish, you're going to be aggressive. So, like, Britney Spears. And so I can tell right off the bat, thanks to Gerard Butler, that this is definitely taking place in Ireland. And so it stars Nicole Kidman post World War II. They're living in this massive mansion, very like The Haunting of Bly Manor adjacent. And these two children happen to suffer from a particular disease that makes them very, very sensitive to sunlight. So all the curtains have to be drawn at all times. They cannot have a lot of light. There really cannot be any direct sunset or sun rays directly onto their skin. And so these kids, they're waiting for their dad to come home and everything seems fine. There's a new nanny that comes on. And at first, you're just kind of seeing this family dynamic. Everything is great. Grace is very protective over her children. And then you start to see things take a little bit of a turn. These kids are starting to see things. They're starting to see certain people. And apparently, these certain people are speaking to these children, letting them know that this house belongs to them. So they are going back to Grace and trying to convince her that this house is haunted by these ghosts that are convinced that they are intruders on their home, that they have to leave. Now, they can't leave and they don't want to leave. Grace doesn't, I should say, because again, she's waiting for their husband to come home. And because this is based in World War II, it's not like she could just pop him a text and let them know where they're going, right? So they have to stay put in order for her husband to know where they are and to be able to meet back up with them. So at first, Grace doesn't believe this, right? She's just like, everything is fine. Like, you guys are just, it's your imagination. You're just seeing things. And the nanny then starts to get on board, and she starts saying things to the children, like, I've seen them too. I've seen them too. And eventually, she's like, just give her some time. Give her some time, and she'll see them. And, then eventually, Grace starts saying crazy things that, kind of hint that she's starting to see it too. She's like, sometimes the world of the dead gets mixed up with the world of the living. And, it's just, you think it's very cut and dry, right? You think that they're living in this house, that these ghosts have died at some point in time, and that when they moved into this house, these ghosts were haunting this place. They haven't left. And that's when we get into the twist of this movie. And it turns out that the ghosts of this movie are not ghosts at all. They are actually people that are performing a seance. And why would they be performing a seance, would you say? Well, because, hold on to your hats, it turns out that Grace and her children are the ghosts. That's right. Take a minute to let that sink in. Grace, Anne, and Nicholas are the ghosts of this house. And Victor and all of his friends, who you originally assume are the ghosts of this movie, are actually people that are trying to draw them out. And it turns out that in a fit of mania, insanity, whatever you want to call it, Grace ends up killing her children and killing herself in the process. And that Victor and all of his buddies are trying to draw them out so that they can now live in this house. Dot, dot, dot. Crazy, crazy, crazy. This movie is amazing. It is slow. So I will say that. This is one of those movies that requires you to really, really be in the mood. And I know that that's not always easy to say. I know myself, like at the end of the day, like I am wiped. Like even when my kids are on their best behavior, like I am still absolutely exhausted. And I've said this before, like I have a 2-hour window before with like when my children go to bed, then I have to be in a REM cycle. Like it's 8:30 right now. Like I have an hour to go until I have to be in a full blown REM cycle. I have to put on Vanderpump Rules, turn off all the lights, put on my fuzzy socks, and just pass out. And if not, then I'm exhausted and grumpy when I wake up in the morning. So I get it. Like watching a movie that requires a lot of brain power is not always ideal, but I promise this movie is worth it. It is so, 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 so good. It actually, so there's one particular scene in it where Anne has this like sheet over her head and she's like, ooh, like she's doing some, I mean, that was terrible, but she's doing some kind of like little humming to a song. She's playing with this little dolly and Anne walks over and she's like, what have you done with my daughter? And actually she does it in an Irish accent. So it would be, what have you done with my daughter? And Anne goes, are you crazy? I am your daughter. And that was immortalized in Scary Movie by some Michael Jackson wannabe. And quite frankly, I actually think that like that scene where Anna Faris or whomever it is at the time that's walking over and asking that question, and then she lifts up the sheet, and it's actually Michael Jackson. He's, and does some kind of like, ouch, come on, dance afterwards. Like to me, that is actually way more iconic than the actual scene. But not many people know where that comes from. So, you know, hot tip, if you want to impress your friends on a trivia night, that's where it's from. So again, to recap, you got to watch this movie, but you have to promise me that before you watch it, because if you are tired, you're not in the mood, and you put this on, you're going to be pissed at me. I'm going to get a DM or a nasty text message that's like, I've just wasted time of my life. I played on my phone the whole time. But I promise you, if you watch it on a day where you are just in the mood, you want to pop the popcorn, you want to turn your phone off, you want to grab your favorite soda pop or your glass of wine and snuggle up to this movie, you will not regret it. All right, so let's talk about my number 4 pick. We are going to go with The Village. Now, this is really controversial because I actually have to admit, when I first watched it, I was probably 16. And I wasn't a huge fan. I did not like it. I had a very visceral reaction. But again, to be fair, I was 16. I wanted shock value when I was 16 that went beyond like intellectual understanding. Like I really just like wanted like a Saw movie. Like I was really, really into the Saw movies. And that's probably like a good plot twist to share, you know, of course, because like at the end of the first Saw movie, it's like that guy that's like sitting in the puddle of blood. It's like, oh my gosh, he's not actually dead. He's actually Jigsaw that's just been lying in a puddle of his own corn syrup or vomit or what have you for however many days. Which, by the way, I mean, that is devotion. But those movies, I have evolved. I am not into those movies anymore. I want sustenance. I want quality. I want a movie that is going to be thought provoking. If I wanted to be shocked and awed with absolutely no depth whatsoever, then I would just probably watch like some remake of Friday the 13th or Halloween, where it's literally just titties and blood, titties and blood. And like, I'm sorry, but I am 32 years old, and I would like to think that I'm a little bit more cultured than titties and blood. You know, I want a little bit more than that. So I circled back to the village. I rewatched it a couple of years ago, and I gotta say, I'm pleasantly surprised, and I stan it here. I said it here and now. I stan the village. So it's starring, I mean, this cast is stacked. You've got Sigourney Weaver, William Hurt, Joaquin Phoenix, Bryce Dallas Howard, and Adrien Brody. Those are your top billed cast. And so takes place in the very late 1800s, definitely pre-industrial revolution, this small town in Pennsylvania. And it is run by elders. So you've got, you know, particularly William Hurt. He plays the main character, or one of the main characters, Edward, who is one of the high elders within the town. And just to set the tone for you, you know, it's just this very quiet, docile village. And everything kind of runs on a system, right? You know, everybody has their job, everybody goes to church, everybody follows the rules. And the biggest rule of the village is not to go beyond the wall. Now, beyond the wall is the woods, and inside the woods are creatures that they refer to of those we do not speak of. So they don't actually ever have a name. It's just those we do not speak of. And it has to be said, so this was written and directed by M. Night Shyamalan, and we all know how I feel about M. Night Shyamalan's Lady in the Water. I don't need to go into any more detail. I would say at this point, you could probably listen to any one of my episodes at this point now and get a general overview on my opinion on that movie. But I do have to say that as far as these creatures, the ambiguity, the veracity, and just the overall visual effect of these characters is pretty brilliant. You know, you don't actually get to ever see them. They wear these red cloaks, so you can obviously tell that these are, at the very least, a four-legged creature that can get up on its hind legs, or possibly a two-legged creature because they have cloaks, right? We have to assume that they're intelligent beings, otherwise, you know, they'd be going raw dog in these woods without any kind of cloaks. And it's never really explained. They have these big, giant porcupine adjacent spikes on their back, and they tend to have a thirst for human flesh. So every now and again, you'll see this massive animal carcass show up at the edge of the wall, and it's just, there's a lot of fear associated with those when we do not speak. And the main thing that tends to attract them are colors. So one thing that I do like about M. Night Shyamalan is that he is a very, very, very visual director. He uses so much association with color. It was so great. You know, even in The Sixth Sense, you know, obviously I mentioned at this point, spoiler alert, that Bruce Willis's character, whom you think is just a standard child psychologist helping out a kid who sees dead people. Turns out that he himself is one of the aforementioned dead people that this child sees. And it just, man, like that movie is so amazing. But what's so great about it is if you rewatch it after understanding that plot twist, you can very vividly see how M. Night Shyamalan chooses to use color to associate when something bad is going to happen. He always wants to associate the color red. When something good or docile is going to happen, he always uses the color yellow. And he really extends that into this movie as well. So all of the people within the village wear a yellow robe, whereas, of course, those whom we do not speak wear red, and anything red attracts them. So there's no red allowed whatsoever within the village. And again, like this is just, it's a village that follows the rules. Well, we're going to go ahead and cut to some of our main characters now. So we have Lucius, who's played by Joaquin Phoenix, and Ivy, who is played by Bryce Dallas Howard, and Noah, who is played by Adrian Brody. Now, Ivy and Lucius tend to have a forbidden attraction to one another. You know, they do at first, it's very sweet and innocent. You know, in church, they're giving each other the side eye and they're looking at each other sweetly. And then they eventually work up the courage to talk to each other. You know, it feels very like fifth grade. You know, I remember my very first boyfriend in the fifth grade, his name was AJ. We dated for a year and I think we spoke maybe twice. That's just how things worked when you were that young. And that is pretty much how things happen here in this village. Well, eventually Lucius and Ivy take things to the next level. They hold hands and things, you know, it's getting kind of hot and heavy and out of control at this point. You know, if you're holding hands, like you have got to notify these parents about what they're doing and, you know, because it's just getting out of control. So Noah decides to step in because Noah himself, he too has affection for Ivy and he decides to take matters into his own hands and plunges a knife into Lucius. Now, this is obviously a big no-no in the village. But because this we're talking about 1800s, you know, it's not like they have an EMT readily available to fix Lucius, right? So Ivy decides that she needs to go across the woods to find the next over village to find help. And so she is able to get Lucius into a position where he's at least stable. And then she breaks loose. She makes her run for it. She crosses into the woods and goes to the forbidden area to try to find medicine to save Lucius. Now, sounds pretty open and shut, right? Like everything seems like you have an idea of where things are going. But let's not forget, this is M. Night Shyamalan. I mean, he is all about the twist. So Ivy finally makes it to a break in the woods. She's finally seeing that there is the end of the woods. And what does she see when she gets to the end of the woods? Well, she sees a road. And we're not talking about an 1800s road. We're talking about a modern day road. That's right. This village has been plopped into the middle of just some random Pennsylvania land, and they have created the illusion to all of the people living within the village that their world is their world. They have no idea that this modern day technology, cars, electricity, television, cell phones, all the things, they have absolutely no idea. It's totally, totally alien to them. So, you know, Ivy sees a car and thank God it's a police car that she just so happens to stumble upon and reveals to her that, you know, she's got everything wrong. It's modern day, you know. And it turns out that the elders of this town have all suffered some kind of tragic loss that is in direct relation to the times. You know, so you've got somebody who, you know, died in a tragic automobile accident, you know, somebody who's succumbed to drugs, and all of them have come to the realization that it's just all about the times, that they need to go back to a time when life was simpler, where there was a lot less temptation. And so that's what they decide to do. They decide to build a village and just let everybody believe that that's that. And that's really where the movie ends. Like, you don't really get to see what happens when everybody decides that they're going to go back to, you know, what's going to happen. Is Ivy going to show up with, you know, a team of police officers? They're going to take Lucius to the hospital, give him some stitches, and then let everybody decide if they want to have like a little rumspringer and jump out into the real world, or if they want to stay in the village. You know, you don't get to see it. I personally think that they need to make a village too for that reason. M. Night Shyamalan, you heard it here first. Reach out to a girl, drop a girl a DM, and let's talk. All right, so let's talk about my number three pick, and that is Identity. Now, the first time that I ever saw this movie, I was living in Findlay, Ohio. I was, oh man, probably like 14 or 15. I don't think I could drive quite yet, so somewhere around that age range. And I was still in that phase of life where I wanted to have all of my girlfriends over. And even if it was in the middle of the day, we wanted to black out all the windows and put on a scary movie and order Godfather's Pizza and watch movies that we knew would scare the shit out of us. Like, that was our thing. And honestly, I gotta be totally honest. I don't know if I've ever gone out of that phase. Like, I could do that right meow. Like, if my girlfriends called me and said, hey, like, your kids are sleeping, your husband's going to take them tomorrow morning, he's calling off of work so that you can sleep in because that's important. We're going to have a movie marathon. I'm going to order a dessert pizza. Come on over. Bring the movies. I'm there. I mean, you don't have to twist my arm. I honestly don't think I've ever gone out of that phase. But Identity will always stay with me because when I was in the crux of that phase, this was definitely one of the main movies that I loved watching. Now, this, again, is a stacked cast. You have John Cusack, Amanda Peet, Ray Liotta, John Hawkes, John McKinley, Brett Lowen, and Pruitt Taylor Vince. And this movie first takes place, you're starting to see how it is an ensemble movie in which you have several intertwining plots, but only in the beginning. So in the beginning, you just see how every single person has ended up in the same place, right? So you've got, you know, Amanda Peet, for example, she plays the character Paris, and she is a hooker or a sex worker would be now the politically correct terminology for that. So she's a sex worker who's coming from Vegas and she's on her way to Florida. So she's going on a massive road trip. She runs into a huge deluge and decides to take refuge at this hotel. Then you've got John Cusack's character, Ed, who is a professional driver. And again, they run into the exact same rainstorm. All the roads are blocked. They run into John McKinley's character, George, and his family. And they all decide that the best thing for them to do is to go to this hotel and take shelter, let the rain stop. And when the roads open back up, they'll go. And so one by one, it shows you how this huge rainstorm has impacted each character within this movie and how they each have come to the conclusion that they need to go to this hotel. So they all end up there. John Hawkes, who plays Larry, is the manager of the hotel. So he gives everybody their numbers and everything seems fine, right? You know, Larry is like a little off. He gives me that like Steve Buscemi vibe. Like, the only other movie I can clearly remember him in is Hardball with Keanu Reeves. And don't even get me started on that movie, because that movie is Keanu Reeves's best work. And I am including The Matrix. Come for me if you feel like you have to, but hashtag G baby forever. If you know, you know. Anyway, so they're all at this hotel, you know, they're getting everything figured out. It's way too late. So the kitchen's closed. So they're all trying to fight for the Cheetos and the vending machine. And they're doing their thing and everything seems fine until it doesn't. So it turns out that one of the people at this hotel is a psycho killer. And people are getting picked off one by one within this hotel. So eventually everybody gets together into a room and they decide, you know, very like the thing adjacent, you know, they all like have to stick together. If we all stick together, then clearly at some point, eventually the killer will reveal themselves. And you know, while they're together, everything seems fine, but then they start to realize that they have really strange similarities. Like, first of all, they all have last names of a state. You know, it's like Ed Rhodes and Paris, Nevada, Larry Washington, so forth and so on. And then they also, weirdly enough, all share a birthday. And per the IMDb trivia, and thank God they did because I am not a math whiz, but the likelihood of 10 different strangers all sharing a birthday is about 1 in 16 trillion. So there's that. And, you know, a lot of strange things are happening until the twist. Sorry, it's been a long day. And then you realize that these 10 strangers are a lot more than just 10 strangers, that they actually all are 10 personalities that are inhabiting the body of one person. And that is a gentleman named Malcolm Rivers, played by Pruitt Taylor Vince. And he is brilliant. Like the way that his eyes move, like he moves his eyes from side to side. And it is so creepy. But I have to imagine, like I'm kind of doing it right now. It's like, first of all, I can't. My eyes just go crossed. And then second, like the headache, like that guy must have had to take an extra strength Tylenol before every single shoot. Otherwise, he probably had the gnarliest migraine. So anyway, his psychiatrists and all of his doctors, he is actually awaiting trial to decide if he needs to be put to death or not, because he has committed an extremely heinous crime that's resulted in the death of 6 civilians. And so his doctors are trying to prove his insanity, and they have gone together to create a simulation, if you will, in which all of his personalities are now forced to confront one another. And the way that they have done it is in this hotel. And so every single time that a character is killed, or excuse me, a personality is killed, it is quite literally the death of that personality within Malcolm's mind. And their goal is to pick them off one by one until you have actual Malcolm there. Because his doctor is very convinced that Malcolm is actually a very gentle, kind-hearted, law-abiding citizen, but that one of his personalities is the maniac. And so you don't know who it is. It is just, it's so much fun. That I'm not going to spoil for you. I'm going to let you figure that out on your own, but that is so much fun. So even when you come on to the plot twist, you understand what that is. There's still this fun element to it of wondering which personality it is. And it is just, oh, it's so good. I mean, the writing is amazing. The character development is amazing. The twists and the turns, the acting, it is just, it's such a great movie. Every now and again, I'll shout out to my friend Molly that I used to give a lot of movie advice to. And I've mentioned before that she does not like a movie that's going to give big time scares, you know, in terms of gore and, you know, gratuitous violence. And this to me is like the perfect movie for her. This is the perfect movie for anybody that wants to be scared, but doesn't want to have like super gnarly nightmares and get grossed out by gore. It's not gory. It's not gratuitous. There are a lot of jump out moments, that's for sure. But at the end of the day, this honestly is like the perfect scary movie. It has the chills and the thrills and the twists. And at the end of the day, you are so satisfied with the ending. Once that credit rolls, you just take, oh, it's so good. It's so good. Take my word for it. If you haven't already watched it, check it out. Much unlike the others, this is a great movie to watch if you just want to have fun and turn your brain off, because you don't have to actively engage in order to understand what's going on. It is just a fun, fun time. All right, so let's move on to my number two pick. This is my number two favorite plot twist, and I'm so excited about this one. This is The Prestige. This honestly is, it might be in like my top 25 favorite movies of all time. Like, this movie is stellar. So this movie, again, another stacked cast. You've got Hugh Jackman, Christian Bale, Scarlett Johansson, Michael Caine, Rebecca Hall, and David Bowie. I love David Bowie so much. My obvious favorite movie with him is, I mean, it has to be Labyrinth, like, obviously. He is so good as the Goblin King, and I am obsessed with his song, the Dance Magic Dance, Dance Magic, put that magic spin on me. I mean, that movie is like probably the closest to hallucinogenics that I will ever get. I am, fun fact about me, I am far too controlling to ever be able to take any kind of a drug that is going to get me out of control. Like, I honestly can't handle it. I love being in the driver's seat of my life and my body. So I say no just because I know that any trip that I would ever go on would most certainly be a bad one. And I'm not a masochist, so I'm not going to do that to myself. But if I want to feel like I'm tripping in a great way, I'm going to watch Jim Henson's Labyrinth and watch David Bowie dance about in extraordinarily tight pants. All right, so we've got Hugh Jackman. He plays the character Robert. He is married to the lovely Julia, who's played by Piper Perabo, most notably known for Coyote Ugly, I would say. And the two of them are a wonderfully happy married couple. And the two of them together, their profession is that Robert is a magician and she is the lovely assistant. You know, every single magician needs a pretty assistant in a leotard to help out with a magic trick, right? So they have this whole plan. Every show, she sits in towards the front, and when he asks for a volunteer, she, you know, so generously comes up and gets changed in her cute little outfit. And Christian Bale, who is his partner and very good friend, he plays Alfred. And so together they tie Julia's hands together. Robert ties the hands, Alfred ties the feet, and they put Julia into a water tank, and Julia miraculously is able to get out every single time. Now, it just so happens that Christian Bale wants to try a new trick that involves a new knot. Now, this actually is going to result in the very tragic death of Julia, in which she is not able to get out of this tie, and so she ends up drowning in this tank. Now, Hugh Jackman, as I previously mentioned, is madly in love with his wife, Julia. And so this takes a very happy man. And once you've taken away the only thing that he ever cared about, it now has become his mission to destroy Alfred. So what was once a friendship quickly becomes a rivalry. Now, fast forward to a couple of years, Alfred has started his very own magic show, and, you know, he's got a pretty successful career. You know, he's met the love of his life through Sarah, played by Rebecca Hall. He's got his own little posse. He's got this like mysterious, shy guy named Fallon, who's more or less his right-hand man. You know, he's kind of his like do everything guy, right? And so he's got it made and everything's great until Robert comes back into the picture. And Robert has decided that he is going to do everything that he can to beat Alfred. You know, he hires his own main man cutter, who is played by Michael Caine. And also he hires Olivia. She's played by Scarlett Johansson. And of course, being her sexy self, her job is to seduce Alfred and get all of his secrets. So of course, this first originally was a friendship that quickly turned into a rivalry. And then from there, it evolves into this obsession that just eats away at Robert. And, you know, who once was a very loving, charismatic, kind person becomes obsessed with being the best. He's got to be the absolute best. He has to beat Alfred. And he sees Alfred's show. And Alfred does this one particular magic trick where, and he calls it this transported man, where he's in a box that's on stage. And all of a sudden, you know, it's got some electro lights and it's like all of the thunder and the lightning and everything seems crazy. And then all of a sudden, Alfred disappears in front of your very eyes. There's no curtain, there's no nothing. And then all of a sudden, Alfred reappears in the very back of the audience and takes this massive bow, and it just wows everybody. And Robert himself goes back and says to Olivia, "It was the most amazing magic trick I've ever seen." And so now he is on a mission to figure out how he does it. How do I do it? So it's not just about now being the best and beating Alfred. He has to figure out how Alfred does it and sabotage him. And you know, this is very like Walter White adjacent, right? So it's like you're watching Robert evolve and become this dark person and this person that just has all this plaque built up in his heart to the point where he is willing to hurt Alfred no matter what the cost. You know, it's almost like one of those moments where it's like, you know, if Julia could look at you now, like what would she think? And it's just, it's so interesting from a character development. Like Robert's arc is brilliant and Hugh Jackman is brilliant. Can we talk about Hugh Jackman for a second? He's the GOAT, seriously. He does so much. In one moment, he is like jacked as all get out and he's the Wolverine. And then the next second he's wearing a top hat, dancing around in a glee-like fashion. You know, this is the greatest show. And then the next he's in The Prestige, you know, acting like this dark, twisted character. It's so amazing. He can do it all. Seriously, he is the true Renaissance actor of our decade. And so here's where the twist comes in. Robert has found a way to figure out Alfred's trick. He's going to travel to the United States and he's going to see this professor, this man named Tesla. And he is played by the brilliant David Bowie. Now, it has to be mentioned. So this was directed by Christopher Nolan. And I actually think this is my favorite Christopher Nolan movie. I know he did all the Batman movies, including The Dark Knight, but this movie is brilliant. And so he wanted David Bowie as the character of Tesla. And he didn't want anybody else. This specifically was written with David Bowie in mind. And so David Bowie originally was like, I'm going to pass. Like, this isn't for me. So he flew David Bowie out and told him, like, look, you're my man. Like, Tesla is eccentric. He's wild. He's really out there with his thinking. Yet he's so brilliant that it's almost turned him into somewhat of a Mad Hatter. And the way that he was able to like so poetically describe Tesla and how much he felt like David Bowie could bring to that character and really complement and emphasize all of his personality traits through his own eccentricness. David Bowie was sold and he just decided to do it. He took a chance. And I'm so glad because I love, love David Bowie. Love, love, love him. So he travels all the way to the United States to see Tesla. And now Tesla has what you would maybe call actual magic, but this is more science, where he has found out the way to clone another person. And so he is able to, Robert is now able to clone himself in order to perform this trick of Robert's, the transporting man, right? So he's not really performing the trick, right? Because he hasn't truly figured out how Alfred does it. But essentially, he comes back, he's in this special box. This box, now Robert is the one inside performing the trick, and this box is actually cloning him. And so Robert, and so through this, he, you know, he's sitting high, he's sitting pretty, he is cocky, thinking that he has figured it out. But little does he know that Alfred has something bigger and better up his sleeve. So now, one thing that is said in the very beginning of this movie is Alfred is saying this to Robert, and he says, "The secret impresses no one. The trick, you use it for everything." And so what he is trying to say, but that you don't fully understand, is that a good trick is used always. And in the moment when he is describing this, he is depicting a man who appears to be crippled. You know, in his everyday life, he's got a massive limp. He always appears to be extraordinarily weak. But then when he's performing his magic show, he is showing how he can give himself miraculous strength. Well, it turns out he actually is extraordinarily strong, but he just acts as though he is weak at all times. And that is his trick. And so that is in the very beginning where Alfred is able to reference that and say, you know, true, true magic tricks are all about sacrifice. And then you get into the crux of the twist, which is that Fallon, who is, as I previously mentioned, is Alfred's right-hand man, is actually his twin brother. Can you believe it? His twin. He has a twin, but nobody ever knew. He's kept it secret their entire adult lives. So they each get to play the character of Alfred, or the person Alfred, half the time. So he's explaining this to Robert towards the end of the movie to say, we each lived half of a full life. They shared a life, and together they committed to the ultimate, ultimate magic twist, which then gives us the ultimate plot twist. Oh, this movie is so, 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 so good. And I know not everybody is into magic, but you've got to get this movie a try. Like 100%. If you even remotely like any other Christopher Nolan movies, Inception, The Dark Knight, any of those movies, like, you truly will absolutely go bonkers for this movie. It is so well written. The writing is so quality. The acting is amazing. The character development is so amazing. Like I said, I love watching an arc to a character. I love a villain that allows you to have some empathy, right? Because, you know, Robert, again, he turns into a monster, but you see him when he's a beautiful human being with a beautiful life, and you see that all get ripped away from him. So you have empathy for him. You understand his pain and why he's doing what he's doing. It just, It is so brilliant. You have absolutely got to check it out. There's not a dot of this movie that is scary. It is suspenseful at times, but scary it is not. It is seriously like one of my favorite movies. You have got to give it a try. If you haven't already checked it out, please, 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 please do so. Drop a girl a DM and say, "You're welcome." All right, so without further ado, let's roll into my favorite plot twist of all time. And we're going to go with a classic for this one. We are going to go with Psycho. Now, this movie was made in 1960, and it was directed, of course, by the infamous Alfred Hitchcock. Now, he was not known for scary movies up until this point. He did like North by Northwest. Like, he was not known for his scary roles. But apparently, he was just really over the Hollywood fluff of using these huge names and, making movies that felt like they were just going with the grain. He wanted to go against the grain and do something that he felt was groundbreaking. And so this certainly fit the bill. Originally, when the studio read the script, like, everybody was appalled, by so much. Like, I can imagine that you think like the idea of like having murders on scene was what was appalling, and it certainly was. Like that, and then like even having like a toilet on screen was considered like absolutely taboo. Like, it is just wild how controversial this movie was, and he decided to make it. I mean, there's actually a lot of fascinating documentaries. There's even a podcast about this entire movie. Like, it is so good. And so fascinating what it took to make this movie. And so this movie had some well-known names, but certainly not big studded stars. So you had Anthony Perkins, Janet Leigh, Vera Miles, John Gavin, and Martin Balsam. And it's all about the character Marion Crane in the beginning. It revolves around her. She's a secretary. She's not very happy about the way that her life has gone. She's not satisfied. And she really, really wants to run away with her boyfriend, Sam. But Sam is a divorcee. He's, riding the alimony pony. So he's not really in a financial position to get remarried. And, she's just, Marion's not thrilled with that. And Marion, who, by the way, is also played by Janet Leigh, it decides to run away with Sam. Sam is played by John Galvin. And so she is given the task at her job to deposit $40,000 into the bank. And Marion is a naughty, naughty gal because she decides to run away with that money and use that as the nest egg, if you will, to start up a life with Sam. And so she's running away. She's driving in her convertible. She's gotten away with it. She is naughty. And she decides to retreat at a hotel because, it's late. She's tired. She's been on the road for an awfully long time. So she stops off at a motel, Bates Motel. And so, everything seems just totally fine. She checks in. There's just this lovely lad by the name of Norman Bates, and he is the manager of the hotel. He runs the hotel alongside of his mother, and together they live on the house on top of the hill that overlooks the establishment. And, Norman is shy, but Norman's very kind. He's very, very sweet. He makes it pretty clear that he's not super, super social. He appears to be an introvert. Maybe he's like, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe he's like a Taurus or something. I have no idea. That was just a total throwout. But, he's definitely a sweet, docile creature. And they're making some small talk. And, Marion makes the comment at one point, don't you ever go out with your friends? And his retort to that is, well, boy's best friend is his mother. And I hate to say it, but there's like a sick part of me that kind of hopes that Wilder thinks that about me, probably at least until he's like maybe like 8. Like I really do hope. Like sometimes he always tells us, like I got it today that I'm his best friend. And I don't hope that that changes. But then, you know, I think about the context of this movie and you're just like, let's sign you up for T-ball, huh? So anyway, so Norman has disclosed to Marion that his mom is more or less insane at this point. You know, she's very old and decrepit and she's just not well. And she's very cranky and very demanding, and that he's just, you know, kind of going through the motions. And so everything seems fine. You know, she can't help but be a little creeped out about all the taxidermied animals that he has, but more or less everything's copacetic. So she checks into her room. She decides to take a shower to wash off the putrid stench of guilt from having thieved $40,000. And, you know, she's kind of thinking to herself, like, do I want to give it back? Should I go back? Should I not go back? And, you know, Norman, it turns out, has a little peephole in which he's able to see what's going on. And he's peeking for just a second, like not long enough to see really what's going on, but enough time to get excited, if you know what I mean. And then it cuts back to Marion. You know, she's taking a shower, she's sudsing up her hair. You know, and then all of a sudden the shower curtain rips open and you see the shadow of what looks like an older woman, followed by the amazing score. Now, before I do the score, I think we all know the sound that I'm talking about, but Alfred Hitchcock actually wanted that scene to be totally silent. But the composer, Bernard Herrmann, shout out to him. Because the entire score of this movie is made entirely of string instruments, and he felt very, very strongly that this needed some sound. So he came up with the idea. So you see the knife, and the knife, you know, is obviously it's in the 1960s. This was a controversial movie, but we haven't quite gotten to blood and titties yet. So it's really just like the motion of a knife, like going up and down, almost like in a robotic fashion, if you will. And then just cutting back to Janet Leigh, just kind of, you know, thrashing. But you don't actually see any blood. You don't see anything gratuitous. But it is accompanied by the and it is just, it is so good and so creepy and so amazing. And so Norman goes back, he goes into the room, he's able to see that something is wrong, and he freaks out. He's like, oh no, mother! And like he recognizes that his mother has done this. And so in a just a fit of panic, he cleans up after, he makes everything right again, but he is just terrified, frightened, appalled, and you just feel so bad for Norman because you're just like, this is just so sad. Like, this poor guy is like, he actually liked Marianne, he liked her, and his mom just got in the way and just murdered her, and now he has to clean it up. Like, it's just, it's so sad and gross. And okay, so the movie progresses, and Sam, you know, as time goes on, Sam is like, where is my bottom bitch with my $40,000? Like, I thought we were going to run away together and get married. Well, you know, obviously, Marion is unavailable at this point. She's indisposed. And so he decides to go looking for her. He contacts Marion's sister, Lila, who is played by Vera Miles. And the two of them go looking for Marion. And so they start to try to retrace her steps. And they're able to trace them back to Bates Motel, where they run into, of course, to Norman. And everything seems okay, but there's just some unanswered questions. You know, Marion was clearly here. Where is she? Did she say she was going to go somewhere else? Where is Marion? Where are my 40 G's? And at the same time that this happens, you have somebody else come up, and that is Detective Milton Arbogast. Now, he has been hired by Marion's employer, because of course this 40 G's were not deposited, and now Marion is nowhere to be found. So you've got both parties looking for Marion. And at this point, like, Norman's starting to sweat, right? Like, you've got a detective, and then you've got these two other people who are looking for Marion. He's starting to feel the pressure, right? And of course, you know, Mother's going to come out to do some of his bidding. And that is when we get to the twist. Let's get to the twist, shall we? So Lila goes snooping into the house. She wants to figure out what's going on. Where is Norman? Where is his mom? WTF. She goes down to the basement where she finds, wait for it, the decaying corpse of Norman's mother. That's right. Norman's mom is dead. So if she's dead, who the hell has been this curly-haired woman that's offing all of the patrons of this motel? Well, it's Norman. It is Norman Bates. Well, it's Norman Bates's body, I should say. Norman just so happens to suffer from dissociative identity disorder, otherwise known as multiple personality disorder. And Norman, you know, didn't have a great upbringing. His mother was extraordinarily overbearing. She was cruel and insensitive and shamed Norman for every single one of his impulses and denied him access to the real world and made him believe that the only true companion he could ever have in his life is his mother. You know, there's, I think it's Psycho, one of the sequels, they made a bunch of sequels. And in one of them, you see a flashback to where his mom is tickling him. And, you know, he's being tickled, and he's at that special age where it's like you don't really understand what happens when you get, again, excited. If you know, you know. And so Norman gets aroused, and instead of just kind of like seeing that and like just stopping and, you know, not really bringing a whole lot of attention to it. Because, you know, Norman's a very young boy at this point. He is young, too young to be like thinking that it's anything other than just like a very innocent, very weird and strange situation that you just obviously want to get away from, but nothing to make him feel bad about, right? Well, you know, his mom's not winning Mother of the Year anytime soon. So she sees that Norman has been aroused, and she decides to scream at him, yell at him, lock him in the closet, shame him, and tell him that he cannot come out until he has decided that he will no longer give in to his sexuality as a man. She makes him put on a dress, and it's all very confusing, all very cruel. And you can just kind of see that dynamic on how Norman has really become the way he is. Well, I think at one point there was a quote in the movie, you're going to have to forgive me because I don't remember exactly what it is, but something to the effect of like, a son is a poor excuse for a lover. And so eventually his mom does meet a lover, and that poses a huge threat to Norman, right? Because the only person that was ever allowed in his life is his mom. And now that she's getting laid on a regular basis, she's no longer in need of forcing this really unhealthy codependency through Norman. And so she kind of kicks him to the curb a little bit, and he hasn't been taught healthy habits. So what does he do? He murders the mom and the boyfriend. And because he cannot cope with what he has done, he slowly but surely morphs into his mother until his mother becomes a completely dominant personality. And it's so good. I mean, the twist, honestly, I feel like this was like the very first massive, massive plot twist that I can ever remember. And there have been so many twists that have been based off of this. I mean, it's so brilliant. And you feel so sorry for Norman. You also, it's like at the very end of the movie, he's you're trying to question whether or not you feel like Norman deserves justice because, of course, this personality of his mother doesn't, right? But does Norman? And it's so good. It's so creepy. It is absolutely a classic. So if you haven't seen it, I absolutely, lutely urge you to check it out. I mean, absolutely. You have got to do this. If you are a movie fan in any way, shape, or form, this has to be a movie that you have seen. So take it from me, pop your popcorn, grab your snow caps, and watch this movie and get excited to brag on the gram about how you're cultured and like above it all because you watch black and white movies. But in all seriousness, this movie is amazing. You have to check it out. If you do and you haven't seen it, drop me a DM and let me know what you think. All right, so without further ado, we are going to move into this week's movie. So this is Deadly Illusions. And so this is starring Kristen Davis. Again, most notoriously known as Charlotte from Sex and the City, she plays Mary. And she is a very, very successful crime thriller author. And she's more or less retired. She's kind of like riding the train of that royalty train. She's just soaking up all the residuals that are coming in from that. And she's married to Tom, and he has a successful job himself, so they're doing very well for themselves. Together, they have the adorable twins, and life is good, right? Well, until it turns out that they do run into a snag of some financial trouble, and so Mary decides to defuse the situation by writing another book. Her publishers and editors have been pushing her to do it for a long time. They've given her a great offer, so she decides to pull the trigger and go ahead and do it. Well, her life is different now because she has two kids and she's more or less a stay-at-home mom. And so now she really feels like she needs help. She needs to find some full-time help to assist her with her kids, the cooking and the cleaning, keeping the house in order. And so she makes it a point to tell everybody that she's really nervous. She's very reluctant. She feels like she becomes a different person when she writes. But she decides to go ahead and go for it. She goes with this very schwanky nanny service, and they find this very angelic, sweet nanny named Grace. Now, Grace is played by Greer Grammer. And so let me paint you a little picture of Grace. So she shows up, she's riding like a little bike with a basket, and she's got this long blonde hair that's tied into a braid with a massive ribbon at the bottom, and she's wearing a shirt that's buttoned up all the way with a little tennis skirt and some tennis shoes, and she's trying to send this message of I'm wholesome to the family. And automatically I call bullshit because everything reads, right? First and foremost, she's very hot. And that's not to say that attractive women can't be conservative. That is absolutely not true. But I don't think that Grace is conservative. And here's why. The braid is fine. The bow is fine. The buttoned-up shirt all the way to the tippy top is fine. What your dead giveaway is, Grace, is your skirt. Your skirt is entirely too short for you to pass off as conservative. Here is a hot tip for everyone trying to wear skirts that make them feel like they are being conservative. Pro tip. If I can see the shadow that your ass is casting onto your upper thigh, then your skirt is too short. There are no There are no ifs, ands, or buts. There are no exceptions in any way, shape, or form. I should not be able to see the 5 o'clock shadow that your ass cheek is casting onto your thighs. Otherwise, it's too short. You are a hussy. So automatically, I call bullshit on the prudeness that Grace is trying to give off. You know, it's just a little too much. She's smiling a little too much. She's coming on like a sweaty tryhard. But of course, Mary's eating it all up. And, you know, at first, you know, for someone that is so, 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 so reluctant about hiring a nanny, she embraces her a lot. Like on day two, she notices that she's wearing like a really old bra and mind you, they've known each other for 48 hours. She takes her bra shopping, but not only that, she like sits in the dressing room with her and like watches her undress and like helps put on bras for her. And like, I think that that's actually very sweet. I think that, you know, if you're dealing with a woman who's very young and very conservative and, she's kind of in that like Britney Spears part of life, right now she's like not yet a girl, not yet a woman. So she's trying to kind of find that vibe of her life. I think that's very darling to take her bra shopping. I don't think it's appropriate that you're in the dressing room with her. And I don't think it's appropriate that you're cupping her breasts after knowing her for 48 hours. I mean, ooh. So anyway, so the movie takes a turn. You know, it is what very quickly you think is going to start off as, you know, a very simple, okay, like I've read this book before. The dad and the nanny are obviously going to hook up and Mary's going to get pissed. And so she's going to fight back and yada, yada, yada. Well, that does not happen here. I'm here to tell you right now that that is not this movie. There is a lot of sexual tension between Grace and Mary, and this movie, I would say, if I had to describe it, there's definitely a lot of 50 Shades vibes going on here. You know, there's a lot of scandalous scenes, and it turns out that the nanny and the mommy are the ones having the sexy, scandalous affair. And it's, you know, this is a not safe for children movie. This is not safe for work. This is definitely an after-hours gig that you gotta watch. But is there a twist in the movie? Well, I wouldn't have just reviewed my top five favorite movies if there wasn't some kind of twist involved. Because remember, bad things happen to Mary when she writes. She gets into a dark place. And when bad things start to happen, Mary blurs the line of what's real and what's not. And for my review of this movie, I'm going to give it a 3 out of 5. And I'm going to do that because this movie is not ever going to win an award, perhaps a Razzie, but it is so much fun to watch. It's not, I mean, the writing's not that great. The acting is so-so, but it is a fun, cheesy thriller. And I got to say, that's actually my favorite type of movie. I love a cheesy thriller. I want a cheesy thriller because the cheese gives it the element that when it is over, I can turn it off and move on with my life. I'm not going to be haunted by it. I'm not going to have, you know, feel like I have to look behind my shoulder when I'm brushing my teeth, kind of freaked out. I can just very, very calmly go into my room, put on my fuzzy socks, watch my Vanderpump Rules, and peacefully slide into my REM cycle while my husband plays Call of Duty. So in short, you gotta check this movie out. It's on Netflix. It's available to stream for free. I'm gonna recommend it. I think it is gonna be fun. I don't think that you will regret watching this movie. All right, guys, we did it. We did it. Now I am about 16 and a half weeks pregnant. So there is a Snickers ice cream bar calling my name, and you bet your ass I'm going to devour that in the comfort of my bed. But before I let you all go, thank you guys so much for going on this ride with me again. If you all really enjoy when I have guests on, let me know, because I would love to invite more people, more friends, more fellow movie reviewers onto this podcast and talk all things movies. If you prefer the solo podcasts, let me know too. Either way, drop a girl a DM. It would mean a lot to me if you would please rate, review, and subscribe this podcast. It really, really helps. Thanks so much, and I'll see you next week.